Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. We live in grim times. The MOU resolving the U.S.-Israel war on Iran is being sabotaged on multiple fronts. Add to this the Europeans' refusal to enter into any negotiations or dialogue with Russia to end the war in Ukraine. Overall, peace is not on the agenda. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest. In Plymouth, we have Patrick Henningsen. He is the editor and founder of 21st Century Wire. And in Prague, we cross to Jason Zahadas. He's an independent journalist and geopolitical analyst. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with Patrick in Plymouth. As I said in my introduction, the MOU is being sabotaged on multiple fronts. We fully expected that from the get-go. It seems to me that the Trump people are having buyer's remorse, because we all know that Iran wrote the bulk of that memorandum, okay? And Trump was desperate and was willing to sign anything. And now they're beginning to realize it's not working for them. And there's only one thing they want. They want the Strait open. Other than that, everything is of lesser priority. And Iran is resisting that. And so I don't know if we're going to go to back to full level kinetic war again, but it seems that at the very least it's going to be a long-term skirmishes. But Patrick, it's not going to open the strait. Patrick.
Well, thanks, Peter. There's a couple problems with how the U.S., of course, has been framing this, is that it's not so much about the strait being open, but who controls it or who sets the rules. And I think that's what really grates the United States more, yeah, is about the control issue. And if you noticed, Peter, when Donald Trump's ire really got raised was when in April reports were coming out that Iran was charging tolls, because you know how Trump's brain works. He's all, that's my money. They're taking, yeah, our money, and we could be doing stable coins with World Liberty Financial, and we should be handling all that. So that's what, in terms of his mind, his business mind, that's what really upset him. And they just can't accept the fact that there's a new rule set in the region, and that Iran's imposed that rule set. And how have they imposed that rule set? Through force, through deterrence. What does that mean for Iran? That means they've elevated themselves to the level of regional superpower, quite clearly, by every metric of international relations. They're now a normative power in the world. And the United States doesn't like this, because normative powers get to set the rules. And the U.S. has a very precarious position in the region. Look, I bet against the MOU from the beginning. And a lot of people railed on me, said, oh, you're so negative. You're just, you know, why can't you just be positive and support the president and Vance? And no, the reason I bet against it is because there's structural problems that haven't been resolved. In other words, no diplomacy, no diplomatic framework, no even like pretending to do diplomacy. This is the problem with the deals, Peter. The deal is undefinable. That's why they don't use it in legal sense. But it's not an agreement. It's not an accord. It's not a treaty. They'll never get a treaty with this administration, because they just don't have the people in place to guarantee that. And other countries can't come into that framework to guarantee anything. So these bilateral agreements are going to fail structurally because of Israel as being behind the U.S. That's not specifically named, although they are vis-a-vis Lebanon. But the point is, there's just too many opportunities for failure. I will say that I don't think, this is going to sound very, very cynical, Peter, but I don't think the Trump administration really seriously was committed to wanting a negotiated settlement. I really don't. Washington plays a double game. They're working on this Lebanon-Shanghai deal, which they've just unveiled over the last 48 hours. That was always their card that they had to play, to basically try to. What it does is this Lebanese Israel deal is designed to nullify the negotiations between the U.S. and Iran. That's all to guarantee basically that this Lebanese-Israel deal will fail, and the U.S.-Iran deal will fail, and then we're back to status quo. And that's what, guess who wants? Well, it's what Israel wants.
Yes, but it's not going to solve Trump's dilemma. And Patrick, geopolitics don't have emotions. I keep telling people that, all right? Think positive. No, I think realistically. Jason, another thing that we have seen, and I want to go deeper in a second on the Lebanon fiasco, is that the Trump administration thinks they can renegotiate as they go along. And again, what are these 14 points? And Iran has been very, very studious in adhering to it. But the Trump administration believes it has the liberty to renegotiate every single point, even make claims that Iran has agreed to things that are simply not true. I mean, and this is part and parcel of what Patrick said. This is a deal. We want negotiations. We want diplomacy. That's not happening. Jason.
Well, if we look at the terms of the Memorandum of Understanding, whether it be regarding sanctions relief, Iranian control over the Strait of Hormuz, this supposed $350 billion reconstruction fund that's never going to come to fruition, by the way, it's exactly how I predicted. The U.S. did not achieve any of its objectives, whether it be the seizure of uranium or regime change, and it suffered a decisive defeat at the hands of the Iranians, who essentially decolonized the Middle East, both with the destruction of U.S. military assets and the crisis in the global energy market. And any deal that Washington reached with Iran would require a full surrender on Tehran's terms, much like when the Roman Empire was forced to surrender to the Sasanian Empire in 244 AD. And recently I saw Tucker Carlson claim that Trump, because of the kind of back and forth between him and Netanyahu regarding Lebanon, that he finally sees Israel as like a threat to his administration. But I dispute that wholeheartedly, because the U.S.'s role in Israeli war crimes and aggression in Lebanon and Gaza is much deeper here. And when it comes to the Memorandum of Understanding, it's part of a wider pattern by the United States to freeze and stall so they can rearm and relaunch armed conflicts at later dates. We witnessed it with the Minsk Accords in Ukraine and the Donbass, as well as the ceasefire agreement with Iran in June 2025 that ended the 12-day war. So Iran and the U.S. have already done this dance before, and the Iranians themselves have no reason to trust the United States because of the 12-day war ceasefire, the fragile state of the current ceasefire, which has led Tehran to walk away from the negotiations, and also because, after all, it was CENTCOM that slaughtered 168 Iranian children with a Tomahawk missile at the elementary school in Manab on day one of the conflict, and also it was Marco Rubio who openly declared on day two or three of the conflict that they knew Israel was going to launch an attack and that there would be retaliations against American bases, essentially confirming, by the way, that the U.S. gave Israel the green light. And then there's the main point of supposed contention, and that is the issue of nuclear weapons and uranium. Well, Iran was never building a nuclear weapon, and this was confirmed under unprecedented supervision by the IAEA, and I will add that IAEA personnel were identified by classified Israeli intelligence documents seized by Iran from the Palestinian territories to be Mossad agents, which led to the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists during the 12-day war. And one other thing I'll mention is that Iran's lack of nuclear deterrence is exactly why the U.S. and Israel felt comfortable attacking in the first place. North Korea, for example, pursued a nuclear deterrence precisely because they saw what happened in 2003 when Gaddafi shut down his nuclear weapons program on U.S. pressure in exchange for sanctions relief, followed by the NATO assault on Libya in 2011. The JCPOA was meant to serve that exact same purpose. And ultimately, the U.S. is using the MOU to achieve the victory that they couldn't get on the battlefield through negotiation. And if there has ever been a greater argument in favor of Iran having nuclear weapons, it's the U.S. and Israel's history of genocidal aggression in the Middle East and 20 years of crippling U.S. sanctions made possible by U.S. dollar hegemony and the balance of power established by Britain and France through the colonial Sykes-Picot Treaty. And right now, the Iranians are following in the footsteps of Cyrus, Shapur, and Ismail in their victories against the Babylonians, Romans, and Shirvanshahs.
But what you're both saying, let me go back to Patrick, you're both saying, and this has been my theory of the case, Patrick, is that the story we're told is that Trump believed that this conflict would be over in 72 or 96 hours. Maybe he believed that, but certainly the Israelis didn't. What they wanted was a new forever war. Once the U.S. got into the conflict, they would make sure that it would only end on their terms, or have a conflict that would just constantly keep the instability in the region and to keep Iran on guard. And so the Israelis are winning hands down, at least on this stratagem. I mean, they're not winning in Lebanon. They're not winning in Gaza. They're not winning in a military sense. But war is the goal. Yeah, that's it. It's not stability. It's not peace. It's just simply war, and you manage it as you go along. Patrick.
Yeah, as the great American anti-war activist at the turn of the 20th century, Randolph Bourne, famously said, "War is the health of the state." I think that applies absolutely to the state of Israel and the state that it's in right now. But you mentioned the word strategy, Peter, and I think that's the key. The U.S. does not have an independent strategy in West Asia. They did before, but they don't now. It's completely threadbare and failed. It was to build up Iran as an adversary for the Gulf states and use that to justify their military presence there and get the Gulf states to spend lots of money in Uncle Sam's military hardware store and then push those dollars through the U.S. system to help the petrodollar stay up. But now that whole protection racket's been exposed as a bad deal for the Gulf Arab states. And so what is the U.S.'s position in the region now? It was to defend Israel. That's really to provide the defense umbrella. And we saw that in Operation True Promise 1, 2, 3, and 4. All of these positions got activated to protect Israel, every U.S. naval asset, every base. And it was to protect Israel and then use as a launching pad to attack Iran. But that's not a strategy. That's Israel's strategy. Israel has a strategy in the region, and they're very open and clear about it. They've written about it. They've published papers. They're open about the Greater Israel Project in the last 12 months, more than ever. So that's the problem. The U.S. Are left with tactics, and what are their tactics, but really support operations for Israel's strategy. That is the number one problem. So the U.S. does not have agency in the region. They're really executing the wills of Netanyahu's office, the Likud party, and the Israel lobby. And that goes with Lebanon as well.
An example of that is that we had J.D. Vance going on talk shows, podcast, anybody that would listen to him. And he's talking about how the memorandum of understanding is working for the United States. And then you have Marco Rubio come out with this Lebanon fiasco. I mean, does this administration even talk among themselves?
Well, look, they're dead serious about this because they're so committed to helping Israel achieve its objectives. And they're willing to do that at the expense of the Lebanese. The United States and Israel are actively trying to foment a violent civil war in Lebanon. There's no mistake about that. So the whole issue of Hezbollah, Peter, the whole prescription of Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, that's an Israeli policy imposed on the U.S. and its allies.
All right, Patrick, I have to jump in here. We have to go to a hard break. And after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing some real news, and the real news that Patrick mentioned at the end of the first part was the role of Hezbollah in all of this. Go ahead.
That's the central issue. Thanks, Peter. You know, look, you understand, Americans need to understand that policy begins in Israel. It comes through Washington and then boomerangs back to Beirut. And that policy is the U.S. audits every piece of military equipment that the Lebanese armed forces is allowed to have or not allowed to have. They can't have air defense. They can't have an air force. Ergo, they can't defend their airspace. Israel reserves the right to use Lebanese airspace. and they can't defend their southern border, and they don't engage the Israeli army. Guess who's left to engage the IDF? Hezbollah. That's by design, so that they can isolate them and paint all this under the banner of a war on terror, ergo justify all of the collateral damage, the dead civilians, the displacement of 1.5 million people, all of that. It's all allowable, like Gaza was allowable under the aegis of a war on terror. That is the sticking point of all of this. It's that label. And until this is addressed, and it's not at the end of the world to reverse a proscription. They've done it with the PLO. They did it with the MEK, Peter, in America, for different reasons, not positive, by the way.
What is so dispiriting about all of this is that the Israelis and the Americans have a willing figure, not a power center in Lebanon to go along with this. It's the level of cowardice is just extraordinary. All right, let's move on to the other grim place in the world that I said in my introduction at the start of the program. Jason, I find it really quite remarkable that Marco Rubio said to Congress is that what we all know about the Ankara process of last year. There were only proposals. There was no agreements. Okay, and unfortunately for the American people, the people that populate the U.S. Congress are just dimwits, because a senator or a congressman should have turned around and said, "But yes, Mr. Rubio, but it was our proposal to the Russians. So you turned down your own proposal. The Russians never rejected it. That never gets into the news. That's why this program exists." Go ahead, Jason.
That's the thing, is that like lately there's been this narrative that's been going all over the media, going all over social media, Twitter, Telegram, and that is that there is a U.S. European split on the matter of Ukraine. But it's pure theater. But Donald Trump has no intention of seeking peace with Russia. He is merely performing an imperial division of labor as per his administration's national security strategy, which is to build up the European arms industry while he focuses U.S. military assets on the Asia Pacific, on the Middle East, and on Latin America, because we're now seeing the USS Nimitz get sent to Cuba. And he pursued this strategy only after his previous attempts last year in 2025 at gaining a ceasefire in a frozen conflict similar to Minsk for the purposes of rearming Europe, failed. And I should also add that much like Israel with Iran, the United States is still providing Ukraine with the intelligence data it needs to carry out acts of terrorism on Russian territory. And according to Emmanuel Macron, Trump has openly given up on peace with Moscow and is open to increased sanctions on Russia and aid to Ukraine on the basis that on that point,
you know, I did kind of a forensic deep dive. That may be Trump's position. It's amazing the number of people in Europe that speak for Donald Trump. We have a dearth of words from him specifically on this. But, you know, Macron, Merz, you know, I guess Stammer is still, you know, packing his bags. But, you know, they all speak for Trump, though he's been quite limited in what he's had to say. I'm not disagreeing with you, but the narrative that is being curated right now, that Trump is all on board. We'll see about that. Patrick, one thing is for sure is that Trump is certainly, and his administration, are not trying to put into check the escalatory language coming out of the Europeans. And the Russians, as a result, if we look at their foreign policy leadership, they have all but given up on American diplomacy. They haven't said it exactly, but in reality, they have. Witkoff and Kushner, I guess they can come to Moscow. You know, I'll give them a tour of the underground. It's really quite beautiful, but nothing is going to be accomplished, and they know that, Patrick.
I think they are more interested in the caviar dinners, Peter, than seeing the Moscow underground. But just on that front, I just want to say, you know, Russia is miles ahead of the U.S. They have absolutely managed this fake diplomacy that the U.S. has deployed by deploying their own pseudo diplomat who is very versed in American culture and politics, Kirill Dmitriev. and he's babysitting them. And Moscow knows this. So they're like, Lavrov's like, you're not serious enough to send Rubio? Well, I'm not coming. So we're going to send our guy from Miami. So good luck.
He's a money guy. He's an investment guy. They probably all get along over dinner.
It's a brilliant strategy. They've already priced in the U.S. unprofessionalism and the lack of real diplomatic structure. The Russians already priced this into the equation. They're going to get on with business, like the Iranians have already priced this in, by the way. The same thing. They failed miserably. The U.S. has failed on every single major deal or major geopolitical flashpoint. And they're just not able to take the ball over the finish line. And on this particular front, I don't think Donald Trump has any real understanding, the depth of understanding, to understand what's really at stake and to understand what's really happening. I question his ability to comprehend the history, the context, the geopolitics. I don't think he's capable of that. And I don't see the advisors around him that are either, quite frankly. We see people like J.D. Vance using Geneva as a platform to campaign for 2028. He has no business at a high-level negotiation as a vice president. That is so a break in normal protocol. And it's also, it leaves an air of unaccountability because there's accountability with civil servant or a cabinet or a secretary of state because things have to go through official channels, not the president's website that he owns called True Social. This is just why there's just going to be continued failures from this administration. And on the war hawking from Europe, Peter, the escalation. So this is dangerous for the U.S. Even to be taking a back seat because they're allowing much more clever operators to fill in that vacuum like the Europeans. And they're just going to create a situation where I don't mean to be cruel in historical terms, Peter, but Europe's got kind of a bad record when it comes to, you know, intra-European conflicts, irrationality and making bad decisions and not even in their country's or population's interest. Only in elite interest. I mean, isn't that the story of European history? And the U.S. provided some kind of a ballast, at least, to that. But now the irony is only a competent U.S. administration engaged in Europe can mediate. And we don't have those two things right now, which is hugely dangerous. The British, the Germans, and the French, especially the British, what they're talking about in the think tanks like RUSI and all of these organizations, that they're planning to overwhelm Russia with swarms of autonomous drones to immobilize the state and to bring things to a grinding halt. And they're going to win. They're going to win this war against Russia. So that's what they believe throughout Europe. That's what Stubbs in Finland is saying as well. They think that Russia's bluffing. That Russia's bluffing, they're not going to do anything, and that they can keep pushing and pushing, and it'll be death by a thousand cuts. And if the U.S. thinks that this isn't going to be a problem very soon in the near future, then this is woefully naive on the part of the Americans, unless the Americans are in on this. Because America has a role, Peter, of watching Europe tear itself to pieces and then walking in at the end with a big broom and a dustpan and calling it reconstruction. America's legacy as well.
But see, what the shift that I see going on, particularly with interpretations of what Anchorage really meant. Obviously, Jason's already mentioned it. It's another Minsk ploy. Okay, you know, buying time. But Jason, the difference is now is that instead of the Russians, instead of talking about winding up the special military operation in Ukraine, now they're talking about preparing for war against Europe. That's a significant discursive shift, and it's very, very dangerous. These are very serious issues, gentlemen, and I don't think the Europeans are mature enough right now to comprehend what they're doing. Both Russia and Europe preparing for war with each other. This is dangerous. Jason.
Well, the reason why is because Moscow is sending a clear message to the West, which is that the slaughter of Russian civilians and acts of terrorism by a NATO-armed Ukraine will not be tolerated and will not go unpunished, and that Russia will not become a debt slave to the IMF or a vassal of NATO. Russian sovereignty in particular is the biggest red line, and that is what's being reflected in the recent round of strikes on Kiev and other major Ukrainian cities, as well as the use of Oryzhniks. The strikes on Starobelsk, the strikes on the school bus in Bryansk, and in Starobelsk, they murdered 21 girls or something like that. Russia wants to bring an end to this conflict by peaceful means, but if the West and their proxies in Ukraine have zero interest, and so far that's the case, then the aims of the special military operation will be achieved by force, even if that means there is a Russian flag flying over Kiev. When the SMO began in 2022, Russia's global backing was somewhat limited, which is why they have focused their resources on the Donbass and rotated troops to minimize casualties. However, in the past few years, they have now built the strongest military in the world. They've deepened their ties with China, North Korea, Iran, the global South. So they have the capabilities to achieve total victory and deal a decisive defeat to NATO's war machine. The Russian war correspondent, Alexander Sladkov, got it 100% correct when last month in May, he said that the longer the war keeps going, it will only lead to more Russian soldiers and civilians being murdered at the hands by the Kiev regime and its various Nazi battalions, as well as its sponsors in NATO and the European Union. And the Russian people feel the exact same way, especially in the border regions, which are under daily bombardment by the Ukrainians. And so the best way that the Russians can respond to Western aggression is by maintaining pressure on Ukraine's energy infrastructure, and also potentially even targeting key Ukrainian political decision-making bodies and the core of Kiev's national economy. I would even advocate for reinstating General Suravikin as the commander of SMO forces due to his successes in turning the tide of the Syrian war in Bashar al-Assad's favor.
We're rapidly running out of time, but there's one issue that we'll probably talk about in the future because it is on the agenda. Given the rhetoric coming out of Europe and the indecision on the part of the Trump administration, this war could expand into other parts of Europe and could happen quite easily. And that is very dangerous because, of course, we don't know what will happen. The law of unintended consequences kicks in. That's all the time we have. Patrick, Jason, thank you very much. I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.